Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Professor Jason Stanley. He's the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, the author of five books, including most recently, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Dr. Stanley, or Professor Stanley, welcome back to the program. It's been about a year, I think, since we talked, and I'm wondering, are we there yet?
Well, fascism is talk is certainly much more prevalent in public discourse. When I published my book in 2018, people said, "Oh, this is an exaggeration. You're using words that are extreme. This is just a low point for democracy." But I think right now you see the effects of fascist ideology and the social and political movement that is Trumpism on the administration, on its institutions, and on its reactions to events very clearly. And for that reason, we find many people in public life debating whether the term applies. That said, yeah, it's less important to focus on the term and more important to focus on the dangers that confront us.
And those are?
Key to fascist ideology is a denial of reality. The leader is infallible. The leader can do no wrong. And I think what we have to look at right now is not necessarily fascist regimes, but what is it in a fascist outlook that makes reactions to events so perilous? So, for example, COVID-19. So in fascist ideology, the leader creates their own reality. Like when Trump says things like, testing is the problem, we're doing so many tests, and that's why we have so many cases. It's just such a bizarre comment because it suggests that the truth is just created. It's not out there. The truth is just, you know, what you document as the truth. As Hannah Arendt said, it's not enough for the Nazis to abolish, to claim that unemployment has been reduced to zero. They must abolish unemployment benefits as part of their propaganda. And that's what we're finding, this kind of denial of reality by a leader that thinks that can only see the reality he wants to see. He creates his own reality. And that's the kind of ideology that is so perilous in the face of a crisis.
The old classic definition of fascism, referring back to like the 1983 Merriam-Webster dictionary, was fascism is the merger of corporate and state interests combined with belligerent nationalism. You've taken it beyond that, considerably beyond that, to talk about, you know, the mythic past and the anti-intellectualism and hierarchy and victimhood and Arbeit macht free, work makes you free, and all these things. How are those characteristics uniquely of fascism as opposed to just kind of garden variety tyranny? Or I'm thinking of like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Erdogan in Turkey. They're embracing everything that you're defining as fascist, yet nobody is describing them as fascists. They're describing them as authoritarians or tyrants.
I've certainly described Orban as a fascist, Erdogan as well. I mean, they fit. They're practicing fascist politics. That's what they're doing, and their regimes are even more advanced on authoritarianism than our own regime. They've dismantled elections. Orban has seized total control. There's no more free press in Hungary. So those are regimes that are autocratic, far right, ultranationalist. So I think, if we think of fascism as a social and political movement, those regimes do fit largely with the definition, but they attack universities. Viktor Orban threw Central European University out of Hungary, and we're seeing those similar attacks here. And of course, the Trump administration is very close with law and justice in Poland, Orban in Hungary.
Fidesz.
So there are strong connections between these far-right ideological, social, and political movements. And I think they do channel fascist ideology.
So how do we best stop or defeat this here in the United States?
Yeah, well, we have to. There's a strong, first of all, how do you confront a leader who represents themselves as infallible, who pushes forward, who presents themselves as tougher than anyone else, as the only one who defines reality? So how do you confront a leader like that? One thing you have to do is you have to make it clear that they have not imposed order, that things are falling apart, because they inevitably do under such regimes. So the protests on the street, I think, are very important, though they're long-standing protests about long-standing problems. And what Trump will try to do is he'll try to change the subject. He'll try to change it from racial equality and racial justice and equality to law and order. That's the stock move here. What you have with this ideology is everything fits into a friend-enemy distinction. Ultimately, reality becomes too pressing to deny. And I think that's one thing we're seeing with COVID-19 is the pressures of reality. Trump can't simply, he's trying to sort of just deny it. The very disturbing move of putting the COVID-19 data, directing it to the Trump administration first rather than the CDC is an example of that. Right. But reality will intrude, and one has to emphasize that, and then one has to push back against this idea that he's infallible, super tough, and not let the subject be changed from, you know, the misery the country is facing.
Right, the failures of his fascist regime. It's been suggested that COVID, there were some Republicans, actually some never-Trumper Republicans, back in March, February and March, who were suggesting that a COVID outbreak in the United States could be Trump's, you know, burning of the German parliament building, the Reichstag-Gebouw. And it looks like it hasn't worked out that way. But Donald Trump back in 2020, or 2012 rather, when Obama was running for re-election, repeatedly tweeted that any day now Obama's going to start a war with Iran in order to get himself re-elected. He clearly believes that a crisis is necessary for an incumbent president to get re-elected. What should we be watching for?
We should be watching for manufactured crises. I think COVID-19 plays into what he can do because he's been so incompetent on that. But we should look for manufactured crises. The misrepresentation of protests as fundamental threats to law and order, trying to connect COVID-19 to immigrants, so thereby saying like his ultranationalist program is a protection. So misrepresentation of social and political facts. We need to also be careful about militias, about calls for violence.
So ICE those is now training civilians.
That's
teaching
right.
Teaching them weapons and how to do civilian arrest. Isn't that the brown shirts?
That, and he's calling for the police. He's repeatedly calling for the police to take a partisan side.
Yeah, amen. Professor Jason Stanley, thanks so much for dropping by today. It's great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Professor Jason Stanley, his book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. It's brilliant. If you don't have it, get a copy. We'll be back. So we've got a new video up over at TomHartmann.com. There's a really troubling concatenation of events that are happening in the United States right now. We created these concentration camps for refugees seeking asylum. This was Stephen Miller's big project. And we've got concentration camps for children, concentration camps for male adults, concentration camps for female adults. And now we've got this virus sweeping through the United States, and people are starting to die in these concentration camps, which has provoked ICE to, or whoever's running them, to deport hundreds of the children back to the countries that they came from without their parents, which is mind-boggling, and in many cases, carrying disease. This is serious stuff, and we need to be talking about it. The new video is over at TomHartmann.com. And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. On a trip to COVID-19 riddled Florida, President Donald Trump not so cryptically revealed that he had something big planned for Venezuela during a meeting with leaders of the U.S. military's Southern Command. So he gets together with a bunch of generals who are responsible for looking at Central and South America. The part of our military is divided. There's the Southern Command, there's the Central Command, you know, the CENTCOM, the Middle East. There's, frankly, I don't know the whole long list of them, or the relatively short list. I think there's 7 or 8 of them, but there's these, you know, regional command structures. This is the one for the South, for Central and South America. And this is what he said to reporters, quote, "Something will happen with Venezuela. That's all I can tell you." And then he said, Washington, D.C. will be very much involved in what's going to happen with Venezuela. Now, it is true that on Trump's orders, the Southern Command has moved a whole bunch of military forces into that region, principally into Colombia, and that Trump has put a $15 million bounty on Venezuelan President Maduro's head. And now Elliot Abrams, yes, that Elliot Abrams of Nixon fame, Elliot Abrams of war in Vietnam, Elliot Abrams of Iran-Contra, Elliot Abrams, good God, he has been appointed Trump's special advisor on Venezuela. And then this is where it gets really nasty. Trump has put new sanctions. Well, Abrams announced this recently, a brand new sanctions on not just Venezuela, which is under virtual total blockade, but on any company anywhere in the world found to be helping with the importation of any goods into Venezuela in any way. This is an attempt to kill, to destroy Venezuela. And people are dying right now as a result of it. They don't have access to medicine. In many cases, they don't have access to food. Abrams even managed to force Lloyd's Registrar, which is the shipping registry, to withdraw their insurance and registration to ships that Elliot Abrams and Donald Trump say have broken the blockade, which means that they can't dock anywhere in the world. So it's not just a matter of a ship taking something from Chile to Venezuela to feed people or medicine or something like that, that may never do business with anybody anywhere, you know, anything having to do with America. But now, under this new policy that Elliot Abrams has put out, that ship won't even be able to dock back in Chile or Chile. I mean, this is mind-boggling. The UN rapporteur for Venezuela, or for human rights, excuse me, visited Venezuela and said that over 100,000 people have died so far as a result of this blockade that the United States has unilaterally imposed, and that the U.S. is guilty of, in his words, crimes against humanity. And why is Donald Trump doing this? Well, it turns out that 92% of Venezuelans in Florida in the 2013 election who were able to cast absentee votes, you know, in Venezuela, voted against Maduro and for the opposition candidate, Radonsky. But I don't know why Trump wants their votes, because they're not American citizens. They can't vote in the United States. What am I missing here? And now Joe Biden is trying to out-hawk Trump on Venezuela, which is just stupid. But, you know, there it is. So number one. And number two, and I mentioned this last week, I think we're still waiting for the next shoe to drop. President Donald Trump said he's going to announce soon that he's taking action against cities run by, quote, liberal left-wing Democrats, end quote, that are out of control with protesters and demonstrations. He made that announcement in the Oval Office. He specifically named Seattle, Minneapolis, Portland, and Detroit. We had over this last weekend federal officers come into Portland. Portland Police, Oregon State Police, every other police agency that operates in Oregon is banned from shooting these so-called less deadly weapons. They are deadly. You've got six people now so far that have lost an eye as a result of police firing these so-called less deadly weapons, these so-called rubber bullets and things at people. But in this case, they shot this kid in the face. These federal officers broke our laws here in Portland and in Oregon. They broke our laws and shot this kid in the face. And he has a fractured skull and broken bones all through his face, required major reconstructive surgery. And Donald Trump is bragging about this. And he says, we have other cities that are out of control. They're all run by Democrats. They're liberal left-wing Democrats. We're going to straighten it out.
Right. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
He's also got a task force on this with Bill Barr, this acting Homeland Secretary Chad Wolf, and the director of the FBI. Brilliant.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Tom Today we're reading from Martha Nussbaum's new book, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. This is from the introduction. There's a lot of fear around in the U.S. today, and this fear is often mingled with anger, blame, and envy. Fear all too often blocks rational deliberation, poisons hope, and impedes constructive cooperation for a better future. What is today's fear about? Well, many Americans feel themselves powerless, out of control of their own lives. They fear that the American dream, the hope that our children will flourish and do even better than you have done, has died, and that everything has slipped away from them. These feelings have their basis in real problems. Among others, income stagnation in the lower middle class, alarming declines in the health and longevity of members of this group, especially men, and the escalating costs of higher education at the very time that a college degree is increasingly required for employment. But real problems are difficult to solve, and their solutions take long, hard study and cooperative work toward an uncertain future. It can consequently seem all too attractive to convert that sense of panic and impotence into blame and the othering of outsider groups such as immigrants, racial minorities, and women. They have taken our jobs, or wealthy elites have stolen our country. The problems that globalization and automation create for working-class Americans are real, deep, and seemingly intractable. Rather than face those difficulties and uncertainties, people who sense their standard of living declining can instead grasp after villains, and a fantasy takes shape. If we can somehow keep them out, build a wall, or keep them in their place in subservient positions, we can regain our pride and, for men, their masculinity. Fear leads then to aggressive othering strategies rather than to useful analysis. At the same time, fear also runs rampant among people on the left who seek greater social and economic equality and the vigorous protection of hard-won rights for women and minorities. Many people who are dismayed by the election are reacting to it as if the end of the world is at hand. A majority of my students, many acquaintances, many colleagues feel and say, often with anguish, that our democracy is on the verge of collapse, that the new administration is unprecedented in its willingness to cater to racism, misogyny, and homophobia. They fear especially for the possible collapse of democratic freedoms, speech, travel, association, the press. My younger students especially think that the America they know and love is about to disappear. Rather than analyze matters soberly and listen to other people trying to sort things through, they often demonize an entire half of the American electorate, portraying them as monsters, enemies of everything good. As in the book of Revelation, these are the last days when a righteous remnant must contend against satanic forces. We all need first to take a deep breath and recall our history. When I was a little girl, African Americans were being lynched in the South. Communists were losing their jobs. Women were just barely beginning to enter prestigious universities in the workforce, and sexual harassment was a ubiquitous offense that had no laws to deter it. Jews could not win partnerships in major law firms. Gays and lesbians, criminals under law, were almost always in the closet. People with disabilities had no rights in public space and public education. Transgender was a category that had as yet no name. America was far from beautiful. These facts tell us two things my students need to know. First, the America for which they are nostalgic never existed, not fully. It was a work in progress, a set of dynamic aspirations put in motion by tough work, cooperation, hope, and solidarity over a long period of time. A just and inclusive America never was, and is not yet a fully achieved reality. Second, this present moment may look like backsliding from our march toward human equality, but it's not the apocalypse, and it's actually a time when hope and work can accomplish a great deal of good. On both left and right, panic doesn't just exaggerate our dangers, it also makes our moment much more dangerous than it would otherwise be, more likely to lead to genuine disasters. It's like a bad marriage in which fear, suspicion, and blame displace careful thought about what the real problems are and how to resolve them. Instead, those emotions taking over become their own problem and prevent constructive work, hope, listening, and cooperation. When people are afraid of one another and of an unknown future, fear easily gives rise to scapegoating, to fantasies of payback, and to a poisonous envy of the fortunate, whether those victorious in the election or those dominant socially and economically. We all remember FDR's statement that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We recently heard departing President Obama say, "Democracy can buggle when we give in to fear." Roosevelt was wrong if we take his words literally. Although we had reason to fear fear, we certainly had many other things to fear in his time, such as Nazism, hunger, and social conflict. fear of those evils was rational. And to that extent, we should not fear our fear, though we should always examine it. But Obama's more precise and modest statement is surely right. Giving way to fear, which means drifting with its currents, refusing skeptical examination, is surely dangerous. We need to think hard about fear and where fear is leading us. After taking a deep breath, we all need to understand ourselves as well as we can, using that moment of detachment to figure out where fear and related emotions come from and where they are leading us. The Monarchy of Fear by Martha Nussbaum. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and our old buddy Greg Pallas is back with us today, or this week, I guess, is the release of his new book, How Trump Stole 2020. And, oh boy. Greg, welcome back. GregPallas.com, okay. The website.
Well, look, Tom, don't panic. How Trump Stole 2020 is, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know who's going to win the election, but I can tell you that Trump has already stolen it. And that's why I wrote the book, because we have to steal it back. If I thought that this is like a locked deal, horses in the wagon, it's downhill from here, I wouldn't have written How Trump Stole 2020. So it's important that you read it so you know how the burglary is being done. You can bust the burglars and save your own vote. And that's really, really important, especially with the news today that they are definitely doing everything to rip apart the post office brick by brick, vote by vote.
Yeah, they sent out a memo saying it's time to slow down the mail, basically. I mean, this is, and of course, a lot of ballots don't get counted because they come in late.
Yeah, well, let me tell you. Okay, in How Trump Stole 2020, I have a special Corona Alert chapter about mail-in madness. Now, people have gotten this wrong. Please, you know that song, Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood? It applies here. I'm not saying don't vote by mail, because you either vote by mail or you die. But I'm saying here's how you get your ballot. In the book, I show you how to get your ballot and fill it out correctly so you don't lose it. 22%, that's from MIT, 22% of all mail-in ballots are never counted. About half of those are because people don't get the ballot in the first place. If you don't get a ballot,
so they're not actually mail-in ballots because they didn't get mailed in.
Yeah. And so, you know, you saw black people lined up, and I want to emphasize it was African Americans lined up in Georgia, Kentucky, and Milwaukee. You didn't see white lines. We were right there. I talked to the ACLU. Here's the deal. Almost everyone in line said this, had the same story. Why are you waiting 4 hours in line in the humid rain? Because I never got my ballot. Now, understand, ladies and gentlemen, you got to. So how do you make sure you get your ballot? The answer is, first of all, make sure you're registered. I've told this to you how many times? It's in the book. Please check your registration online. Re-register if you're not registered. They are not, you know, America is not Oregon, where mail-in balloting works really well. When you're talking about
and
Georgia,
for 20
you're talking
years.
About...
Yeah.
Yeah, and when you're talking about Wisconsin and you're talking about Michigan, good luck mailing in your vote. That's why it's not like black people want to stand in 4 hours of humid rain in Georgia, which is what they did, to vote and get a virus. No. The head of the ACLU told me that she asked for a ballot 45 days in advance, and the ballot for her husband, which she also put in, didn't arrive till the day after the election. Boom, he's got to wait in the virus line. So that's just one of the things I explained in How Trump Stole 2020. 3.3 million votes were not counted. Mail-in votes were not counted in 16. What is it going to be this year, and how can we stop it? We can unsteal the election. Again, How Trump Stole 2020 is about how to steal it back. It's not saying, forget about it, just go home. It's over with. No, but it's not going to be a fair fight.
Yeah, well, if you were preaching, despair and throw your hands up and, just go shoot yourself or something,
I wouldn't write
you
the
wouldn't
book.
Be on this show. Yeah, and you wouldn't have written the book. We're talking with Greg Pallas, the investigative journalist, BBC, The Guardian, Rolling Stone. His new book, How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters.
And let me tell you something. I still own the audiobook rights, so if you get the book today, How Trump Stole 2020, or this week, if you get it this week, go to... Send a note to audiobook@gregpallas.com, audiobook@gregpallas.com with, show some receipt or something, snap, I'll send you the audiobook for gratis, because I've been on the Hartman Show forever. I got to give you something besides your own democracy, and that's what we need. Right. That's the whole point of the book. Steal it back.
Right. Right. I'm curious, Greg, your thoughts on the growing speculation that one of the reasons why Trump is redirecting, forcing, requiring hospitals to redirect their data about COVID to HHS rather than the CDC, to Health and Human Services, is because his toady there, the head of HHS, who was, you know, Alex Azar, who was the president of Eli Lilly and doubled the price of insulin for, you know, to the joy of, you know, diabetics all across the country. You know, he's a good Trump toady that he's just going to start burying the data. The news reports today are that the CDC no longer has that data on their website, and neither does HHS. How does that play into the election? If Trump, you know, he obviously thinks if we don't test, then you won't have coronavirus. So the corollary to that is if you don't publish the numbers about how many people are dying, then you don't have anybody dying, or at least you don't have the perception. I mean, obviously, we're talking perception here. But Trump understands that perception is more important than reality. That's how he's conducted his whole entire life. And that this is part of this plan. What say you, Greg Powell?
Yeah, play this out. Okay, this is continuing the virus. This is going to push the virus into the election. And you think, well, that would look bad for Trump. It may look bad, but don't forget, again, go back to the lines in Milwaukee. Milwaukee went from 180 voting stations to 5. Where is the virus centered? Even with the shift now more to red states, it's still an urban problem because of congestion. What is urban? Urban is a code word for Democratic voters. When you go from
even in red states, you know, Dallas and Houston and Austin,
exactly.
They all have Democratic mayors.
You've got that right. So dig this, like Alabama, okay? You have to notarize your ballot. The Supreme Court just approved that crazy system. How many people are going to say, I can't afford it, it's a poll tax, $15, or I'm going to die if I go try to hunt down a notary? This is also in the swing state of Missouri. Alabama is, of course, the life and death fight for the Senate seat of Doug Jones, the Democrat running for re-election. You have to understand, continuing the virus, forcing people to vote by mail, and destroying the mail system at the same time. Imagine if Trump said, well, everyone's going to have to vote in precinct, but we're going to burn down the precincts. So instead, do you realize that your polling station is your post office? Your mailman is your poll worker. And they are doing everything they can to make sure that you don't get your ballot. Again, 10% of all ballots requested, and that's millions, don't get to the voter in time or don't get there at all. So this is the plan. They are undermining the post office so that they can't, and not the post office, but they're doing purges. By the way, please, if you're on a purge list, 17 million people have been purged, don't know it, you're not going to get your ballot. Okay,
yeah. So, Greg, yes,
the virus is part of the plan.
Are you hearing from any members of Congress that they want to, I realize that H.R. 1, which is Mitch McConnell has killed, would have gone a long way toward helping this situation. Anybody else got any, break glass in case of emergency plans?
Yeah, we have a lot of great legislation, but it's going to die in Mitch McConnell's, lime pit of progressive legislation. So, for example, why, in California, every one of us, we get a mail-in ballot, whether we ask, unless we say don't send it to us. We have a pandemic. They're doing everything to block any program to help you vote. Why do we make voting an obstacle course in America? And, I have a lot of bad jokes in here about the obstacle course, but it's serious business. I'm very, very concerned. There's plenty of plans, but every time the progressives try to make voting by mail fair and easy and democratic, they kill it. The Supreme Court 2 weeks ago said Alabama can require you to notarize your ballot. Missouri, the same. You have to have a witness signature in Michigan, in Wisconsin. Crazy.
Yeah. Amazing. Greg Palast. Yeah, the new book, How Trump Stole 2020. Check it out. Get a copy. Greg, I wish you the very best with this book. It's brilliant. Thank you so much for dropping by.
You're the best, Tom. Thank you. Bye.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman. Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp, as Secretary of State, did everything he could to keep black people from voting and Hispanic people. He just went nuts. Actually, it was about a two-year period. He was the Secretary of State. He was in charge of the whole voting system for the state, and he was running for governor. And so as Secretary of State, he purged hundreds of thousands of people from the Georgia voting rolls. Many of them, large proportions of them, disproportionately black and Hispanic people. He refused to certify the recent Stacey Abrams group had gotten over 50,000 African Americans registered to vote. He refused to put them on the voting rolls in the weeks before the election. He won by, I believe, as I recall, 51 or 52,000 votes, by the way. This was an election that he stole from Stacey Abrams. And now it appears that if he can't, you know, because more and more people are registering to vote in Georgia, particularly minorities. And now he's said, basically, I mean, it just appears that he's decided that if he can't prevent black and Hispanic people from voting, he's going to help them die. I mean, Kemp, like the entire nation, learned back on April 7th in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the CNN, MSNBC, Fox, name it, that disproportionately black and Hispanic people were being infected with and dying from COVID-19. There's a whole variety of reasons for that, but you know, that's when April 7th was the day that America just got, yesterday I said April 6th, I was wrong, it was April 7th, that was the day. And on April 9th and 10th and 11th, purely by coincidence, all of a sudden, all the right-wing talk show hosts, instead of talking about, I mean, even on Fox News, I mean, Tucker Carlson had been saying, hey, you got to be careful. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, hey, it's time to open the country back up, right? Trump is tweeting, liberate Michigan. And guys, you know, armed white guys with guns and Nazi and Confederate memorabilia and flags and stuff are showing up at state capitals and saying, get those disproportionately minority frontline workers back to work. I want the guys working in the kitchen of that restaurant again. I want the guys washing the dishes again. I want the waiter or waitress, the server to be serving me again. Right? Their whole privileged white guy thing. It was as if racists across the country, you know, and Stephen Miller and Donald Trump in the White House figured out that if they actually wanted to reduce America's black and Hispanic population, this was their chance. They could use the virus to make America white again. You could call it the Republican Party's 21st century eugenics program. And doubling down on this apparent strategy, Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp officially banned cities in Georgia from enforcing their own mask requirements. There were 15 cities in Georgia, including Savannah and Atlanta, that had put into place mandatory mask wearing in public in their towns. And Georgia Governor Brian Kemp struck that down. As Georgia's hospitals are reaching capacity, as the virus is ripping through communities of people who can't easily telecommute or work from home, the governor is taking an official step that could dramatically increase infection and death rates among low-income and minority people across the state. I mean, it's hard to imagine that elected officials like Donald Trump and Brian Kemp would be so craven as to intentionally engage in policies that specifically target minority groups for illness and death. I mean, there has to be another explanation, right?
I just can't figure out what it is.
Brian Kemp, this was done by executive order. This from the Washington Post. Megan Flynn, writing for the Washington Post. It's officially official, says Savannah Mayor Van Johnson. It's officially official. Governor Kemp does not give a damn about us. Every man and woman for him or herself, ignore the science and survive as best you can. That's the mayor of Savannah. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, this is the next state over, Alabama. She just mandated masks statewide. Georgia just outlawed masks statewide. Kay Ivey, the governor, the Republican governor of Alabama, said, we're almost to the point where our ICU, hospital ICUs are overwhelmed. Folks, the numbers don't lie. Now, Doug Ducey in Arizona and Greg Abbott in Texas had also issued executive orders forbidding cities in Texas and Arizona from having masks or mandatory masks. But they both walked that back in the last week or so. So what the hell's going on with Georgia? Well, Stacey Abrams, the person that he stole the election from, said more than 3,000 Georgians have perished, disproportionately black and brown Georgians. Doesn't that kind of explain to you why Brian Kemp is all gung-ho on this? I mean, is it possible? Is it even imaginable that there actually is a Republican eugenics program going on? Russell Edwards is the mayor pro tem of Kemp's hometown, Athens, Georgia. He last night called on the governor to resign over this. He said his order today sabotages protections. Words fail to describe this monstrous behavior. And then you look around the world at what's going on. What are other governments doing? I mean, is anybody else like trying to kill their citizens or help their citizens die? Well, for example, Vietnam. This is just an absolutely amazing story. Vietnam has had no deaths from coronavirus. Vietnam's first cases were reported on January 23rd, 3 days after our first case was reported. It was a son and his father who had come from China. As of today, they've had 369 confirmed cases, no deaths. They have 97 million people. This country, just a little smaller than one-third the size of the United States. Hell of a lot larger, you know, three times the size of California, population-wise. They also have had no community transmission for 3 months. Now, how did that happen? Well, back in 2003, when the SARS outbreak happened, Vietnam created an entire massive public health structure. Officials deployed a multi-sector response incorporating the military, public security services, grassroots organizations, and completely transparent communication, effective community mobilization. They did this with MERS, they did this with the avian influenza, they did it with measles, they did it with dengue. It's cheaper to stop diseases in poor third world countries like Vietnam. It's cheaper to stop the diseases than to treat them, and that's what they're doing. I'll give you more details on this in a minute. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And then it just continues. Stick around. We'll be right back. Is the Republican Party intentionally running a 21st century eugenics program?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Separated by the Border, A Birth Mother, a Foster Mother, and a Migrant Child's 3,000-Mile Journey by Gina Thomas. This is from the introduction. How good is your Spanish? And would you be able to take in a 4-year-old girl? She's from Honduras and speaks minimal English. The social worker had texted me on a Friday afternoon. I sat at my desk, bent over my cell phone, reading and rereading the text. My thoughts traveled to Honduras, bachata, balades, clothes hanging on the line. So many things in our lives seem to have prepared us for this moment. My son was attending a bilingual school. I'm a former ESL teacher. And my husband, Andrew, and I speak Spanish. Plus, Honduras already had a piece of my heart. As those thoughts came, I tried to push them away. The voice of logic came in loud and strong. We had just gotten into a routine with Emma, our foster daughter. Two foster children and two biological children would be too much for us to handle. Our first month as foster parents taught us this.
And for the sake of everyone involved, we knew it would be very unfair to try that again. A little later, the social worker called and left me a message saying, "It looks like the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the ORR, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, will get her on Monday in court. It'll only be the weekend. Call me back after you talk to Andrew." I asked Andrew when I got home, "We can manage four kids for one weekend, right?" He said he doubted it would last only a weekend, but I convinced him that if ORR and ICE were involved, they would get her on Monday. A few minutes later, I called our social worker and said that we'd do it. When I walked into the social worker's office, Julia was sitting there in a brand new bright pink Barbie t-shirt. The social worker said they'd found the t-shirt in their clothing closet and Julia wanted it. Beautiful, soft onyx curls framed the girl's umber face. Her dark complexion made me speculate she was from a coastal region. She stood in dirty flip-flops next to the social worker's chair, chit-chatting away in Spanish without a care in the world. "Julia's been talking my ear off," the social worker said. "She's so sweet, but I have no idea what she's saying." Another worker brought in a black tote bag with a few other items from the clothing closet, including a pair of sequined high-top sneakers that Julia had picked out. I began to speak to Julia, pronounced Julia, in Spanish. She seemed happy to hear her mother tongue, but her body language didn't budge. I read that signal loud and clear, so I kept my distance and sat down on the floor. "¿Cómo se llama?" I asked. "Julia. ¿Cuántos años tienes? How old are you?" "Cuatro, four." She looked older than four to me. I had been told her parents were deported and she was left behind. She was under federal jurisdiction. I would find out later this was all misinformation. I signed some papers and said, "We'll see you on Monday." I asked Julia if she would come stay with me and my family for the weekend. She smiled. I told her I had three other kids. Her eyes expanded with excitement. On the drive home, she jolted my Spanish from its slumber. The social worker wasn't kidding about how much this little one talked. On April 6, 2018, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a new zero-tolerance policy in which the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice would partner for the sake of prosecuting illegal entry into the United States. Sessions said, quote, "If you cross this border unlawfully, then we will prosecute you. It's that simple. If you smuggle aliens across our border, then we will prosecute you. If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you, and that child will be separated from you as required by law. If you don't like that, then don't smuggle children over our border," end quote. 6 weeks later, almost 2,000 children had been separated from their parents at the border since the zero tolerance policy took effect. When Sessions announced the administration's new policy, I couldn't comprehend the cruelty. I also wondered if it explained why a preschooler was living under my roof. Julia had come to live with me and my family in February of 2018, and it felt surreal to be a part of her story. She had first been separated from her mother, Guadalupe, called by her nickname Lupe through the rest of this book, by smugglers who were paid to bring them across the border. Julia had then been separated from her stepfather, Carlos, by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, likely because what was recognized by the Honduran government as stepfather was not recognized by the U.S. government as the same, a detail I didn't understand until an immigration expert read the first draft of this book and explained it. Julia had already suffered much trauma, and separating her from her stepfather had only inflicted more. The weight of the trauma that we, as a nation, began inflicting on vulnerable children and their parents was cruel and unusual punishment. When I heard that my own country was going to begin separating children regularly from their parents as a policy, it broke me. Reality became surreal, and Andrew and I learned to live in it, separating the trauma from our emotions so that we could survive. As the veil of Oz is ever lifting from my white evangelical American eyes, what I now see is simply heartbreaking. Government-secured human rights are mostly for privileged white people. Julia is not white. Julia is undocumented. Julia's first language is Spanish. Julia is a girl. These are all labels that set her back in a society made by and for white, passport-holding, English-speaking males. But God, who is neither white nor male, despite my use of the pronoun he, shines his good news on every human being alike. The book is Separated by the Border by Gina Thomas. Rick in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I have a grave concern. I read the article about the 20 million people that may be homeless. starting right. in the fall, and I thought it come to me that could have an impact on the election. Think people that are homeless, recently homeless, they're overwhelmed. They won't vote. Secondly, the Republicans will do everything they can do, change of address, put any number of barriers in the way from brown and poor skin and poor people voting. Then Trump's reelected. The Republicans maintain the control of the Senate. The House maybe is even diminished. And that'll be the end of democracy in America. The Republicans will come with any way they can, because they're thieves of democracy, to keep people from voting. So I think this is a grave concern that people better start paying attention. I call my senators, my congressmen, send an email to Greg Palast and to Stacey Abrams on this. So,
yeah. Not to mention the fact that you'll see an increase in your homeless population. And right now, I haven't seen any good reliable data, because I think we have so badly underfunded services for marginalized people in our society, since 1980, since the Reagan Revolution, that nobody, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, maybe it's out there and I just don't know where it is, but it seems like nobody is seriously collecting this kind of data, on the health of homeless people. But from the anecdotal stuff that I've heard, COVID is just ripping through those communities. And I mean, that's grim stuff. That is very grim stuff. So anyhow, Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Dennis in Aptos, California. Hey, Dennis, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's a eugenics program going on. I have no doubt. We know this has been historically, the Germans did a eugenics program in the first 2 years of the war, until the German people found out what was going on and they were about to revolt. We need something like that now. I mean, next week or so, Pelosi is going to be dealing with McConnell to extend unemployment. I don't know if there's going to be a provision in there about allowing people to stay in their homes and avoid being evicted.
No, in fact, McConnell today came out and said that basically if he can't force children back into schools, he's not going to pass any legislation. That was yesterday afternoon. What's this about the German people objected to eugenics? My understanding is that the German eugenics program, which was started in 1933, where Hitler was sterilizing, or maybe early 34, was sterilizing mentally retarded people and gypsies and whatnot. And then that became the final solution. I mean, that was the extermination of the Jews. That was the high point of his eugenics program. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's the one they had in 39 and 40, where even the war veterans that couldn't return to battlefield, they were being brought to these hospitals so that they could be, injected with something to die. And they
euthanized,
were, taking kids from families. And it was the church found out about it because there were whistleblowers.
I'm not familiar with that history. But Dennis, thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but thank you. I'll have to go back. It's been a lot of years. It's been decades since I read Shearer. We'll be right back. Stick around. Hey, we have a new video over at TomHartmann.com. It is the 12 steps. Common Cause actually put these together, but I boiled them down into a nice little rant on a YouTube video that you can share with friends and neighbors and acquaintances who might be wondering, how did this coronavirus thing get so bad? Why is it that the United States has a third of the deaths in the world? Why do we have over 100,000 dead people and South Korea has 200 and Taiwan has like 70 and Australia has fewer than 100 and has pretty much squashed the virus? Why is it that only 7 people died in New Zealand? Why are so many other countries doing so well and we're not? Well, there's an answer to that question. And I lay it out in this little video. It's over at TomHartmann.com and you can grab it there and share it with your friends. And I'll give you a clue. Almost all of it has to do with things that orange guy in the White House either did or failed to do. But it's a great list. You can check it out at TomHartmann.com. Cassandra and Camus. Hey, Cassandra, what's up?
Hi, good morning. Okay, piggybacking, answering your question, I think it's a stew, and the stew has many parts to it. The question of why Trump and the regime, the you know, the Republicans keep doing what they're doing. They're making the 1% of them that basically funds them are making billions of dollars off of COVID. The eugenics aspect, yes, they're an absolutely racist regime, let's be honest. And
well, they're willing to let kids die in cages. I mean, yeah.
Well, the thing is, America's complacency all along this path, as we've for years now seen the treatment of people from south of the border by ICE, not just through Trump. Obviously, he's the ultimate. This is the end days, all that. But this has been a buildup. We've been at war one way or another in this country, literally war with other countries for decades. And we don't see the body counts. We don't see everything has been whitewashed over. So no one sees anything. So we become very complacent to it. And my point is this. This is the end game. And whether we like it or not, there's going to be a word that's going to be used at some point. And it is revolution. Okay, I'm going to take that off the line. Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Thanks a lot, Cassandra. Yeah, good to hear from you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner, a memoir. This is from chapter 17, about a little more than a third of the way into the book. At first, the revolution only gave the impression of being an historical event like any other, a matter for the press that might just possibly have some effect on the public mood. The Nazis celebrate January 30th as their day of revolution. They are wrong. There was no revolution on January 30th, 1933, just a change of government. Hitler became chancellor, by no means the Führer of the Nazi regime. The cabinet contained only two Nazis apart from him. He swore an oath of allegiance to the Weimar Constitution. The general opinion was that it was not the Nazis who had won, but the bourgeois parties of the right, who had captured, in quotes, the Nazis and held all the key positions in the government. In constitutional terms, events had taken a much more conventional, unrevolutionary course than most of what had happened during the previous 6 months. Outwardly, also, the day had no revolutionary aspects, unless one considers a Nazi torchlight procession through Wilhelmstrasse or a minor gunfight in the suburbs that night as signs of a revolution. For most of us outsiders, the experience of January 30th, 1933 was that of reading the papers and the emotions we felt while we were doing so. The morning headline was, "Hitler called to president." That produced a certain nervous, impotent irritation. Hitler had been called to the president in August and November. He had been offered the vice chancellorship and then the chancellorship. Both times he had set impossible conditions, and both times there had been solemn declarations, never again. Each time, never again had lasted exactly 3 months. Hitler's opponents in Germany at that time suffered from a compulsive urge to offer him everything he wanted, indefatigably, and at an even cheaper price. Indeed, to press it upon him. It's the same now with his opponents outside Germany. Again and again, this appeasement was formally renounced, and again, it gaily reappeared at the crucial moment. Just so today. Then, as now, one's only hope was Hitler's own unreasonableness. Would it not sooner or later exhaust the patience of his opponents? Then, as now, it became apparent that their patience knew no bounds. At midday, the headline said, "Hitler makes impossible demands." We nodded, half reassured. It was only too credible. It would have gone against his nature to ask for less than too much. Perhaps the cup had once more passed from us. Hitler, the last defense against Hitler. At about 5 o'clock, the evening papers arrived. Cabinet of National Unity informed Hitler Reichschancellor. I don't know what the general reaction was. For about a minute, mine was completely correct. Icy horror. Certainly, this had been a possibility for a long time. You had to reckon with it. Nevertheless, it was so bizarre, so incredible to read it now in black and white. Hitler, Reichschancellor. For a moment, I physically sensed the man's odor of blood and filth, the nauseating approach of a man-eating animal, its foul, sharp claws in my face. Then I shook the sensation off, tried to smile, started to consider, and found many reasons for reassurance. That evening, I discussed the prospects of the new government with my father. We agreed it had a good chance of doing a lot of damage, but not much chance of surviving very long, a deeply reactionary government with Hitler as its mouthpiece. Apart from this, it did not really differ much from the two governments that had succeeded Brüning's. Even with the Nazis, it would not have a majority in the Reichstag. Of course, that could always be dissolved, but the government had a clear majority of the population against it, in particular the working class, which would probably go communist now that the Social Democrats had completely discredited themselves. One could prohibit the communists, but that would only make them more dangerous. In the meantime, the government would be likely to implement reactionary social and cultural measures with some anti-Semitic additions to please Hitler. That would not attract any of its opponents to its side. Foreign policy would probably be a matter of banging the table. There might be an attempt to rearm. That would automatically add the outside world to the 60% of the home population who were against the Hitler government. Besides, who were the people who had suddenly started voting Nazi in the last 3 years? Misguided ignoramuses, for the most part, victims of propaganda, a fluctuating mass that would fall apart at the first disappointment. No, all things considered, this government was not a cause for alarm. The only question was what would come after it. It was possible that they would drive the country to civil war. The communists were capable of going on the attack before a prohibition against them came into force. The next day, this turned out to be the general opinion of the intelligent press. It is curious how plausible an argument it is, even today, when we know what came next. How could things turn out so completely different? Perhaps it was just because we were all so certain that they could not do so, and relied on that with far too much confidence. So we neglected to consider that it might, if worse came to worse, be necessary to prevent the disaster from happening. Through the whole of February 1933, everything that happened remained a matter for the press. In other words, it took place in an arena that would lose all reality for 99% of the population from the moment there were no newspapers. Admittedly, enough occurred in that arena. The Reichstag was dissolved. Then, in a flagrant breach of the Constitution, Hindenburg also dissolved the Prussian regional parliament. There were fast and furious changes of personnel in the civil service. The book Defying Hitler.
Leslie in Central Square, New York. You have the last minute, Leslie. What's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Les. Hey, this is ridiculous about the stealing the vote all the time. It's been happening for 20 years now. Democrats got to stand up, do the same thing they're doing. In Democratic states, you put one spot in the state, farthest part from anything, that says just for Republicans voting. That's it. Do the same thing they're doing. It was one person in it, okay? One person, one voting machine. They can do that. If the other, they can do with the other stuff, they can do that.
You know, wait a minute. What am I missing here, Leslie? How do you do this? What are you talking about?
Okay, you set up one polling spot, okay, for just for Republicans in Democratic states.
Oh, you can't do that. Okay? You can't do that. That's not equal protection under the law. It's banned by the 14th Amendment.
Well, they aren't giving you protection.
Yeah, but if you do something for anybody, you've got to do it for everybody. I mean, generally speaking. Leslie, thank you. Unless you're trying to help somebody who has been injured as a consequence of public policy or whatever. Obviously, there are different rules for, like, you know, people who are disabled and, you know, different parking spaces and things. But, you know, that doesn't violate the 14th Amendment. But generally speaking, if you're going to do that, you've got to do it for everybody. Thanks a lot for the call though. And thank you for being with us today. We'll be back same time, same place. We'll be back then. Have a great day. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. Be good to yourself and people.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.